Good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, June the 26th, 2018, 17 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned into the Now program, and today we've got on one of my favorite guests. It's always a pleasure to welcome this lady to the microphones here, but before we do, just a little bit of housekeeping here. Don't forget, next week we will be at the Marion County Fair all week. July 2nd through July 6th, we'll be at the Marion County Fair. Monday and Tuesday, we will be broadcasting the harness racing from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. in the afternoon, and then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, all of our programming will emanate from the Veterans Memorial Coliseum. It is July 4th. It is fair time next week, so don't forget that. And we will be giving away prizes at the fair to the Columbus Zoo, COSI, Tecumseh, the Wilds, and 300 people, the first 300 people to the WWGH booth will get a commemorative fair book from the station, absolutely free, the first 300 people. Coming up next hour, we're going to be joined by a very interesting person, first-time visitor to this program, Kameh Calloway Murphy. That is the 91-year-old daughter of legendary performer Cab Calloway. So stay tuned next hour, Kameh Calloway Murphy. She was also heavily involved in the education system in Baltimore, but Cab Calloway's daughter next hour. This hour, with everything going on, the Supreme Court ruling left, right, and sideways, Maxine Waters' speeches, and Donald Trump's tweets, and travel bans, and people getting kicked out of restaurants, and everything else. Inspector General reports coming out. Who better to welcome to these microphones but a reporter for the Daily Beast and current panelist on the McLaughlin Group, which you can find on YouTube if it's not on in your area by going to YouTube and searching McLaughlin Group. Boy, I'm having a hard time speaking today. Always a pleasure to welcome to these microphones Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm doing okay. How about you?
Doing pretty good. As we approach July 4th, what's it like in D.C.?
Well, as you aptly describe, it's as though, you know, decisions are coming at us with some speed. The administration's then self-inflicted problems at the border, basically overlaying incompetence on top of chaos. Because now how do they reunite the kids that they have shipped all over the country into various network of shelters that many people didn't even know existed? So I think people are reeling from that. And then, as you point out, Maxine Waters, the congressman from California, basically called on people, not just Democrats, I guess anybody who objects, to shame members of the Trump administration when they're seen in public, following up on what happened to Sarah Huckabee Sanders when she attended a restaurant called Red Hen in a rural part of Virginia. And some of the people who work there didn't want to serve her because they object to her being the voice of some of this president's policies, and the owner of the restaurant basically asked her to leave, and she quietly did. So I think people are trying to understand where are the limits of how we behave toward each other in public when we have a president who had a rally last night telling people to get their asses to the polling place and vote for the candidates he approves. So some of this tone is set from the top, but people who want to resist President Trump, I just don't think it's a great idea to adopt some of his crudities. I just don't think that works.
That being said, there's a big primary today in Utah. Does Mitt Romney win the primary?
I assume he does. He's running against a candidate, a fellow Republican, obviously, who's very much in the Trumpian mold and is accusing Romney of, you know, not being Trumpian enough. And what I understand from, you know, reading about the the contest there is that Romney has so far managed to walk a very fine line between being opposed to Trump and being for Trump. And I think Romney, as we've seen, watched him as a politician over the years, he's not a heroic figure. And it doesn't surprise me that he's not coming down clearly on one side or the other. And I expect he will win. The Romney name is so revered in Utah because he turned around the Salt Lake City Olympics in, when was that, 2000 or 1996? It was a long time ago, but he's highly respected in Utah. And I think a lot of people, not just Republicans, I think Democrats are looking to him to be sort of a statesman-like figure should he win this Senate seat in Washington. I don't necessarily know he's going to, you know, go to the barricades against President Trump, but he does sort of speak to a politics from an earlier time, which is not quite as, you know, coarse and critical as it is today.
You know, Mitt Romney, on his primary day, I think there's some interest in talking about him because he's puzzling in a way to me because his father involved in politics. He gets involved in politics in Massachusetts. As everybody has said, Obamacare is pretty close to what Romney Care was in Massachusetts. He runs for president twice. The first time he doesn't get out of the primary. He loses to John McCain. The second time, he does get the nomination, but doesn't really come close to winning. Then he decides to be critical of Donald Trump, gives this gigantic speech in 2016, for those who don't remember, calling him a con man, then takes the dinners to be Secretary of State with Donald Trump when he's president-elect, and now he's trying to get back in the game in the Senate in Utah. What is the end game? Is it just to be the senator from Utah?
You know, some people imagine that he might even run for president again. And, you know, I think to moderate Republicans and a lot of Democrats, he certainly looks a lot better than the current Republican who's in office. But to be realistic, if he gets elected to the Senate, okay, he starts serving in 2019. If he were to challenge Donald Trump in the primary in 2020, he would lose. The primary basically is decided by a closed Republican Party, which is really down to the Trumpian hardcore, and the president's approval rating among Republicans, self-described Republicans, is 90%. So he would not challenge, you know, he could not challenge Trump in the primary and have any hope to win unless things blow up in a way that we almost can't imagine. So then we're thinking maybe a Democrat wins, maybe another Republican wins. I don't know, maybe Trump wins re-election. I don't know. But so now we're looking at 2024, and Romney, I imagine by then, will be in his 70s. So, you know, and a third time, maybe the third time's the charm. I wouldn't rule it out entirely, but I think he just wants to be, he wants to be in the arena. And, you know, the Senate, you give speeches and people cover them and listen to you. I mean, he could carve out an important role in the Senate. And I think here in Washington, the sort of establishment Democrats and Republicans see him as somebody who could work, you know, between the parties, who could be a healing force in the Senate, you know, regardless of who was in the White House.
If in 2020, as you say, very correctly, it will be a closed primary, if somebody does decide to primary Donald Trump, another person who has this problem is our governor, who's leaving office, John Kasich, in January. Now, he faces all the same problems that Mitt Romney would face, and even more. He would be in his 70s in 2024. He would be out of office 8 years, which is a long time. Is there any, could he possibly primary President Trump? Is he, I don't know where he goes. I'm confused now since I thought maybe he could primary.
Yeah. There was a time when Trump first got in that, and you had, you know, Jeff Flake sort of bowing out of the party and Corker and Senator Corker of Tennessee. And you began to think, well, you know, maybe there really is an uprising within the Republican Party. And I was thinking to myself, they're going to be lining up to challenge him in 2020 in the primaries, you know, which is rare. I mean, Jimmy Carter faced a challenge from Ted Kennedy. George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, I think, each faced challenges from Pat Buchanan. None of those challenges were successful. And I thought Trump would be vulnerable and, you know, people would want to challenge him in the primary. But then you look at how he has successfully held his base together and you look at how he governs, which is always with a nod to the issues that infuse and excite his base. And then you look at that number, you know, 90% approval among Republicans. Now, that number of Republicans is a shrinking portion of the electorate. I think in the latest Gallup survey, their self-described Republicans are 28% of the electorate, Democrats 31, and independents were, you know, 42 or something like that. So it's not like the Republican Party is alive and well, but the people who are going to turn out in primaries have to be declared registered Republicans, and his support in that group is still amazingly strong, and that really does doom any challenge to him in the primary unless somebody just wants to do it, you know, to get a forum and to make speeches. And there's not wrong with that. There's lots of reasons to run short of thinking you might actually win. I mean, somebody might want to use it just as a platform to point out that this president faces challenges, and a lot of people, you know, think that he shouldn't be holding the office, and he's done things that are, you know, morally wrong and undermine our values. Maybe John Kasich would undertake that mission, but it would be a very difficult one.
My understanding is that the next presidential election will probably start to get underway about this time next year. People, I think, will start declaring. That takes us through 12 months. Now, if the Dow Jones continues to drop, which it is dropping somewhat now, if he loses the House and Senate in the fall, if he can't get anything accomplished because he loses those. And if, well, does that hurt him? Is he then vulnerable? Do Republicans say, well?
Well, yeah, there are so many ways to spin out what's going to happen to this administration. First of all, on the economy, I mean, he does seem to be, you know, killing the golden goose with these tariffs. They're hurting the very people who supported him. So he could be undermining a very good economy that Barack Obama left him, and that's been going gangbusters, and that typically is a great cushion to, you know, save the president's party in the midterms. In terms of losing the House and the Senate, I think Democrats have a very good chance to take over the House, but when you look at the Senate map, you know, Democrats are defending many more seats than the Republicans, and 10 of them are in states that Trump won some by huge margins. Now, if Republicans did lose the House and the Senate, Trump is so malleable on issues and ideology that, you know, there's one scenario you could imagine where he says, okay, now I'm going to work with the Congress that exists, and he could actually make some deals, maybe, and that perhaps could get him reelected. So I don't underestimate him as a political figure. And I think if all the right-wingism doesn't work and he loses the House and the Senate, he could be a born-again centrist. and he wants to get reelected. Not so much that he wants the job or even enjoys the job, but if you don't win re-election, history regards you as a loser. And boy, it's one thing that Donald Trump doesn't ever want to be called is a loser. That's a name that he reserves for everybody else.
Well, that's an interesting point because most people seem to be talking about, well, if the Democrats win the House, or indeed the House and the Senate, that they would, there's impeachment proceedings and there's things they want to do. But who's to say that Trump would not work with them? I don't know that he's all that friendly with the Republicans, with Orrin Hatch and Paul Ryan.
No, that's right.
Yeah, all gone. I don't know if that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, and Mitch McConnell and the president aren't exactly, buddies. But McConnell has given him all of these judges, and he's remaking the Supreme Court in a much more conservative way. And so he's indebted to McConnell for that, beginning with keeping that seat vacant so that Obama didn't get a Supreme Court appointment. And in terms of impeachment, the House could, I think it'd be very difficult to restrain the House from, if it's a Democratic House, people are going to bring articles of impeachment, and there's going to be several, and it only takes a majority vote to pass those. But the Senate, you need 67 votes to convict, and I think the nightmare scenario for Democrats is that you impeach him in the House, and that he uses that to rally his base, that this is Democrats trying to force out a duly elected president, and then he walks in the Senate, just as Bill Clinton did. Now, I thought that was correct with Bill Clinton. That was a Republican House and Senate, and the 67 votes weren't there in the Senate, and Bill Clinton's approval ratings actually went up. I mean, he lost a lot of time as president, and he could have gotten more tough legislation through if he didn't lose a year to the whole impeachment process. So it's not like it was a cakewalk, but he didn't get convicted, and I don't think Trump will either. 67 senators, again, unless something truly explosive comes out, you're not going to get 67 senators, and so he will use impeachment to rally his base. Well, and increases the division in the country, sadly.
Well, this is interesting, Eleanor, because we don't have the Mueller report yet. Now, we do have the Inspector General report last week, and that was kind of fascinating, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But the Mueller investigation, okay, let's say the impeachment did happen. I was watching a show last night on Watergate, and if John Dean had not testified the way he did, there's a good chance Richard Nixon would have been able to stay. Is there a John Dean or a Butterfield in the Trump administration?
I haven't seen him or her. And actually, what really cost Nixon was the smoking gun was the revelation of the tape and then the existence of the smoking gun tape. And so I doubt we're going to get any kind of tape that's equally incriminating, although I guess you could say some people are looking towards all of the audio tapes that were confiscated from Michael Cohen's office, Cohen being Trump's lawyer of long standing, could be something incriminating in those. But I think the difference between the Nixon and now, if Nixon had had a supportive media like Trump has, maybe he could have ridden out the storm. I think that's the difference. I mean, Trump has Fox News and Breitbart and, you know, people who are willing to defend him. And he also has a Congress that's of the same party and that has not been willing to challenge him in any serious way, at least not yet.
The Inspector General's report last week. You know, we learned that Comey should not have commented. He did that on his own when he came out in July of 2016 and commented about Hillary Clinton's emails, said she was extremely careless, that he was acting alone, reckless, I think was one of the words, extraordinarily reckless, when he reopened the case and told everybody in October of 2016 that there was nothing to the Hillary Clinton thing, and that he was using a private email the whole time. You know, my goodness gracious.
I know. The fact that he was using a private email also makes you realize how incredibly inflated her errors were. And I think the fact that Comey went public, he was under a lot of pressure from apparently some agents in the New York office who were more conservative, and pressure from the Republican Congress, who really wanted to see an indictment. And then Bill Clinton had gone on the plane on the tarmac and talked to Loretta Lynch, the attorney general, and Loretta Lynch was then felt like she'd been compromised, and so she didn't insist that this was her decision to make. She made it clear that she was deferring to Comey. And then he could have just said the investigation is closed, which would be normal FBI behavior, but instead he gave that long press conference where he laid out everything as though she should be indicted, and then said, well, he wasn't going to indict her. And that was the critical mistake. He should not have done that. But, you know, I remembered he was being called on by liberal columnists saying that whatever he decides, he owes it to the American people to explain his thinking. So at the time, he was getting pressure from all quarters, again, including from liberal columnists, to basically show his hand and tell everything and be open about it. And in retrospect, it sowed the ground for Clinton's defeat. And then when he came back the second time, because they found emails on the laptop of former Congressman Anthony Weiner, who's married to Hillary Clinton's top aide, Uma Abedin, and he first sent a letter to the Congress. He was reopening the investigation. And initially they said, oh, there were so many emails they couldn't even go through them. All right, he should not have publicly announced the reopening. They should have quietly gone through all those emails fast and realized there was nothing there. They were duplicates of what they'd seen, and that should never have been made public. And that was really a fatal error in terms of its impact on the Clinton campaign.
Whether or not these people, because aside from Mueller, this is kind of the end of the 2016 election. The books have been written. But, you know, now that we know the books, the Inspector General's report, we do know Russians were against Hillary Clinton and for President Trump. Was there anything, I mean, yes, she didn't go to Michigan enough. Yes, she didn't go to Wisconsin. But honestly, was there any chance she was going to win that election with the way the FBI was acting, the way the Russians were acting? The way...
Well, I think everyone assumed she was going to win, which is why Trump got such a free pass from the FBI. I mean, they were investigating him and his campaign's alleged collusion with the Russians before the election, and a number of people in Washington knew that was the case, and then Minority Leader Harry Reid actually sent a letter to Comey demanding that this be made public. He never got any response. And Comey's explanation later was that, well, he was following FBI procedure. There was no reason to make that public. And he didn't think he was going to be president, whereas with Hillary Clinton, he assumed she would be elected, and he didn't want her to begin her term with this in FBI investigation hanging over her. So the assumption that Hillary would win was very strong, and she did win popular vote, and she lost by 78,000 votes in three states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And 78,000 people you could fit in a good-sized football stadium. So this was not the landslide that Trump makes it out to be. It was a thumping win in the Electoral College. Yes, I will give him that. But Hillary was. It's not like she was so out of the running that she couldn't possibly have won. This election was closer than people realized, and any one of these missteps, you can blame. But the Comey intervention is obviously a very strong contender for what tipped the balance.
When we look at what went on last week, it was kind of interesting with immigration in this country and children. Your co-host, co-panelist on the McLaughlin Group, Pat Buchanan, was on the Laura Ingraham show, and he's come under a little bit of fire in the New York Times for saying on the Laura Ingraham show, he said, this is the great issue of our time, and the real question is whether Europe has the will and the capacity, and America has the capacity to halt the invasion of the countries until they change their character, political, social, racial, ethnic character of the country entirely. You cannot stop these sentiments of people who want to live together with their own, and they want their borders protected. Make no mistake here.
He said something very similar on the McLaughlin Group this past Sunday, and every time before that we have discussed this. He uses the word invasion. He does believe that people from other countries coming into, particularly in Europe, and he believes it here too, obviously, though, that you change the traditions and the ethnic makeup of the country, and that the people who are there are made uncomfortable by it. And the New York Times editorial writer Charles Blow basically called it white extinction anxiety. I think that's appropriate, and I think the people that Donald Trump is addressing are made uneasy by the fact that we are getting closer to a majority-minority country, and I think the current young generation, children today, are majority-minority. And it just, when you look, though, at all, I mean, Pat is Irish ethnicity, and I guess his grandfather, his great, they came here from somewhere else. My parents came from somewhere else. I mean, who says what is the American, the appropriate American ethnic makeup? I mean, he seems to think it's European, but that's not written in the Constitution, and we welcomed so many different ethnicities into this country, and there have been attempts before to really weaponize this issue, but I don't think anyone has done it before as cruelly and as successfully as Trump.
What is going to happen on the border? The kids were separated from their parents. Then we saw this executive order last week, but it's 3 weeks. What is going on exactly for people? Because it seems like a lot of misrepresentation has been going on here from both sides and all the cable channels. What's the problem, and how do we fix it?
Well, the numbers that are coming across are not any higher, and they may be lower than what President Obama experienced in 2014 and in 2016. In 2014, the Obama administration was kind of overwhelmed by the influx of kids coming alone from South America, and they Central America, actually, and they had got some very negative publicity about the conditions of how they were detaining these kids and also families. And that's where the catch and release program began, which is what Trump wants to end. That's because you can't detain a minor for more than 20 days. And if you want to detain a family that comes across with minor or minors separately for more than 20 days, you're breaking the law. And so that's what led to a massive increase in ankle bracelets and having people basically then agree to come back for a court hearing. But then the resources are so strained, the court hearing is sometimes many months in the future, even years in the future. So what's happened in the last day or two here is that Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press spokesman, basically said that they don't have the resources to detain everybody at the border. So they're just basically they're not prosecuting them. And the president has expressed frustration that you can't just turn them back. You can't just instantly deport them, because people, once they're here, they're entitled to due process under our law. So I would say it's a pretty big mess. The administration insists that they still have a zero tolerance policy. They don't have the resources or any kind of plan to enforce it. And they've got kids in shelters around the country, a network of some 100 shelters, we now realize, that you now have kids in distant states that have been separated from their parents, and the administration claims they know who belongs to who, but there's some skepticism that they've been able to keep track of that. So you really do have a chaotic situation that the president is still trying to use to bolster his argument that the country is under threat by this invasion across the border, and he's tied it to the MS-13 gang, which, by the way, originated in Los Angeles in the 90s, I believe. And it's a vicious, terrible gang, but he has so inflated it, turned it into this international terrorist gang. He's like putting it on the same level as ISIS. So he's using this issue really to continue to animate the people who supported him, and he's convinced, and I think he's quite right, that the immigration issue is a large part of why he got elected.
And I want to do this as it happened for people, because this is the last 3-4 days in our country. The White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, goes to a Red Hen restaurant on Saturday night. She has a conversation with the owner. The owner asks her to leave because of the policies of the administration. Then Maxine Waters is caught, Representative Maxine Waters from California, is caught on video at a rally, and this is what she said. I want to quote it here. "If you see anybody from the cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd and you push back on them." And then she said, "You tell them you're not welcome anymore, anywhere." And she also called for the impeachment of President Trump in that same speech, and you can watch that on YouTube. And then the president tweets yesterday, "Congresswoman Maxine Waters, an extraordinary low IQ person, has become, together with Nancy Pelosi, the face of the Democrat Party. She has just called for harm to supporters, of which these are many, of the Make America Great Again movement. Be careful what you wish for, Max." That's 3 days. Eleanor, what in the world is going on?
Well, first of all, Maxine Waters did not call for violence or inflicting harm. She was basically calling for protesting and sort of shaming and calling people out. Now, again, I don't think it's a good tactic. I think it plays right into Trump's hands. And what I've read, the reporting out of the White House, is that Trump's advisors are, quote, giddy that she has done this, because it makes Sarah Sanders look sympathetic, because she quietly left the restaurant. And it, again, it plays right into Trump's hands. And she was on MSNBC last night, Maxine Waters, basically saying, I'm all about the children, I'm not calling for physical harm. But that's how Trump interpreted it. And I think there's some concern that this incredible hostility between the two parties and between Trump supporters and anti-Trump supporters, that, you know, we could end up with some violence. And again, I think that plays right into Trump's hands. And so I just, you know, I think you gotta protest him and you gotta speak out. But when you start, you know, saying that people shouldn't be allowed to go about their daily business at a gas station or a department store or a restaurant, you're, you know, venturing into, you know, territory where if you disagree with somebody's politics, you can refuse to serve them a cake. Or I just don't think it's a smart way to go.
You know, I'm looking at the midterms here, and I see a lot of Maxine Waters on the news channels, Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden every so often gets a quote in there. There are younger people in the Democratic Party who do come on from time to time, but these are the people who seem to be making the headlines almost 2 years into the Trump presidency. Why is this the group?
Well, I think Joe Biden is not going to go quietly into the night. He may even run again. And Bernie Sanders has a following from the presidential campaign, and he has a lot of young people who look to him. In fact, he's endorsed somebody here in Maryland running for governor, Ben Jealous, former head of the NAACP. Sanders' endorsements, he's had very few, if any, winners in the primary cycle so far. Nancy Pelosi is likely to be the next speaker if the Democrats win, and some of those Democrats are going to win, saying they won't support her as speaker, and I think the Democrats are going to have to sort out who they want as their leader. And Pelosi is grown up enough to understand why some people are going to run against her. She just wants the Democrats to win. And I think once we get through the midterms, you're going to see a whole crop of younger Democrats emerge from the Senate. I can, you know, name three female senators off the top of my head, plus Cory Booker, the New Jersey senator, who's African-American. Lots of people are going to emerge. But right now, I think it's just kind of a sorting process. And the Bernie faction of the party versus the Hillary faction of the party are still kind of duking it out here in the primaries, and I think we'll have a much clearer sense of where the Democrats are once the fall campaigns get underway, and certainly after the election in November.
You know, I'm watching this all play out, and last week I thought something that was interesting, where Republican and Democrat first ladies alike all condemned what was going on at the border, every living first lady, except Melania Trump. And what is puzzling to me, I keep hearing the Democrats say the Clintons are yesterday. Well, where are the Carters and the Obamas? I mean, I understand they're not in office anymore and they're not going to run for anything anymore, but where are they on these issues? Why aren't they out there on the programs? Why aren't they talking?
Well, Jimmy Carter is now, he'll be 94 in October, and he's very interested in preserving democracy, and he still travels around the world. He's not going to get involved in the primary process, I think, and he's not going to get personal against the sitting president, and that's kind of it's an informal rule, I think, among presidents. And I think President Obama, I think, feels probably quite correctly that if he enters into the fray, if he takes the bait, so to speak, he will just be a wonderful foil for Donald Trump to further beat up on Democrats and whatever. So I think Obama could well be doing some campaigning selectively in the fall as part of his push on anti-gerrymandering, which he's doing with Eric Holder, the former Attorney General. So I think, the resistance is so far has been bottom up, and lots of people are who were never involved before, and lots of women, and so far they're doing pretty well in the primary. So I mean, I just think that it's evolving as it should.
When did the Clintons become yesterday? Why are they bad for the Democratic Party?
Well, when you're a two-time loser, she tried twice for the presidency, Republicans are much nicer about giving people another try than Democrats are. Democrats tend to always want the newer, the fresher, the younger. I think that's been part of the tradition. And the Democrats, when the Clintons were in office, the Clintons brought the party back to the center. Bill Clinton kind of famously left the campaign trail to go home to Arkansas and preside over the execution of a mentally challenged young man because he wanted to demonstrate Democrats weren't, quote, soft on crime. And the crime bill that was passed when he was president, all of the, the three strikes you're out and everything, basically led to the over-incarceration that we have today. So that was a good idea then, people thought. Now, looking through the prism of hindsight, it doesn't look so great. And so the party today is much more progressive than the party was when Clinton was in office. I mean, he oversaw welfare reform, which a lot of progressives actually, some leading people in his administration quit over that issue. So it's a different time, and I think people realize that it's the party has moved on from that, the kind of centrism and in many ways corporate centrism that the Clintons represented, which certainly it got the Democrats back into power after a long time in the wilderness. But we're in a different political time now.
There are two questions I want to make sure I get in here. It's interesting because Joe Biden, who speculating, could run for president, he's older than both the Clintons. He's a two-time loser. He never even got the nomination for president both times he tried to. Bernie Sanders lost in the primary against Hillary Clinton, yet he's considered viable and a possibility in 2020. Bloomberg, older than Clinton, giving hints that he might want to run, going to spend a lot of money to try to flip the House, in his opinion. These are the people. But the Clintons,
right? They each have a hold on a certain part of the electorate, and I'm not convinced in the end any of those three will run. But if you take yourself out of the running, you immediately lose part of your audience, and each of them wants to maintain their audience. And if you do win the nomination, you run with somebody else in tandem, and so you pick somebody who's younger, I suppose, who could fill in. I mean, Obama was different. He was younger. He picked Biden for the wisdom and everything. So I think our system does protect in the event someone who is older does capture the nomination. But, I think there are going to be upwards of a dozen people vying, and who survives that gauntlet will be very well tested.
interestingly enough, Hillary Clinton campaigned basically on everything Barack Obama was. He campaigned for her just about more than any other president has ever campaigned, sitting president, for anybody else. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump got in attacking Obama, not Hillary Clinton, as not being an American citizen, and Donald Trump won. Does that mean that the Obama's agenda's relevancy is not popular in America anymore?
Well, in the new book out that Ben Rhodes has, who was Obama's foreign policy advisor, he does have Obama in a sort of rare moment of self-doubt after the election, musing, you know, maybe we were wrong, maybe we were 10 or 20 years too soon. I don't think so. I think what Obama stands for, a lot of people in this country support. I think there are cultural forces at work, and you often, in a democracy, you have, you know, two steps forward and one and a half steps back. And I think Trump is in large part a backlash to President Obama. And I'm assuming that whoever we get after Trump will be a backlash, or at least somebody radically different from Trump, because that tends to be how it works.
Eleanor, before I let you go, I want to come back to the Pat Buchanan thing just for this moment, because you know Pat. You've known Pat for a long time, still work with him. Essentially, we in this country are calling people racist a lot. And essentially, this editorial in the New York Times, that's essentially what they're saying about Pat Buchanan, that he's a whitest. Is that the guy you know?
No.
No?
You know, I would have a hard time calling him a racist based on how I see him interact with people. But when you look at the policies, I mean, he basically, I think, takes the position that if, you know, Hispanics can defend their heritage and African-Americans can defend their heritage, you know, why should whites not want to hold on to the heritage they understand? And he's just rooted in the 1950s of, you know, growing up in Washington, D.C., which was segregated, and, you know, going to Catholic schools, and it's just a very, it's a nostalgic view of the country. And I just heard Michael Eric Dyson was saying that this kind of nostalgia that people have is really toxic, and I agree with that. It's remembering and imagining a part of their youth that was wonderful, but it was not wonderful for most other people, and the memories of it are way, way overinflated as well.
Is that possible, in closing, is that possibly maybe what this is with Trump? Maybe it's not racism. Maybe it's just an older view that people over 70 have of their America.
Yeah, but if you look at Trump, though, it's not his personal America. I mean, the guy grew up in a very rarefied atmosphere. I feel with Trump, it's opportunistic. It's figuring out where the grievances are and how the grievances produce votes, and it's the 2018, 2020 version of what Richard Nixon did when he mined all the votes in the South, the Southern Strategy, by, turning race into a political issue then.
It's fascinating. Eleanor, thank you so much for coming on. It is always a pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Eleanor Clift, always a pleasure to have on. We'll be back in just a moment.
FM, streaming live on the internet, www.w.